Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Andrew Hunt and David Thomas. Andy and Dave wrote the Pragmatic Programmer to help their clients create better software and rediscover the joy of coding. The newly revised 20th Anniversary Edition is now available on their website, pragprog.com. Welcome, Andy and Dave.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us. Delighted to be here.
So before we get started into the meat of things, would you guys kind of give us a little bit of an introduction about yourselves and sort of like how you got started in development to begin with?
Well, I'm Dave Thomas, and I have been programming now for, I have no idea how many years, 45 years or something. And I started programming simply because my school ran out of things for me to do at the end of a year. So they sent me across the road to a local technical college. And I kind of beta tested the, I think it was the first year they had run a A-level in computer science, which is this kind of A-level is the sort of national set of exams that you take at age 18, a kind of university precursor. And so I was sitting in this technical college programming in BASIC on an ASR33 teletype, punching all the paper tape, and then once it was all punched, I would connect at 110 board to the, a board. That's, for the people out there, that's about a zillion times slower than the slowest internet connection today. it is literally 10 characters a second. So we would upload our paper tape and run our BASIC programs up on a mainframe somewhere, and I just totally fell in love. Changed my major from mathematics to computer science. And really, the rest is some form of history.
So I got started, I got hooked in the, I guess it was mid to late 70s kind of time frame. We had a teletype with actual paper on it and everything. And no paper tape, though. I was, you know, I came a little bit later, so I missed the paper tape experience. But it was a teletype. And I got hooked because there was this little book at, I think, a Radio Shack that described large-scale integration technology and integrated processor chips and how, you know, it's one of these, the future's gonna be great, kids, kind of Jetsons sort of thing. And I, you know, dumb kid, I kind of fell for it. I was like, well, this is like Star Trek, right? You know, we can have, you know, computers that aren't the size of a house and that you actually have access to and you can make it do things. Now, at the time, all we really could do was like print out pictures of Mr. Spock on the teletype using asterisks, which was pretty cool, you know, for its time, and Lunar Lander and you know, this sort of thing. But the premise of it really hooked me. It's like, okay, this is going to happen. This is a thing, and I can, you know, get in on the ground floor. So that really just attracted me, you know, right out of the gate. And I, you know, started playing with I think 6502 assembler was the first programming language I dug into, a little C basic maybe, you know, then the marvelousness that was Turbo Pascal when that came out, you know, because it had a built-in IDE with WordStar keymap on it. That was brilliant. Still faster than this, you know, multi-giga dual CP quad core nonsense I've got here. But, you know, with all these stupid GUIs, it's like, just give me memory mapped video and boom, you can just bang characters out. It was delightful. At a half a meg, right? I mean, the clock speed was nothing. You could hand crank these things, right? The clock speed was so low. But that's how I got started. And it's been, however many years, that's what 35 plus years, 40 years. And I'm still trying to figure it out too. You know, one of these days we'll learn how this actually works.
So speaking of figuring it out, what are you working on these days? What really drives you from day to day?
So I'm still looking into the Elixir programming language. simply because I think the future is definitely going to be both concurrent and functional, and Elixir and Erlang just happen to be both. It's fun. It would be, I'm having fun with it, but I'm also kind of thinking this isn't quite where I want to be, and but nowhere exists yet that I found that's better. It's got a really cool story, but it still tends towards creating larger applications than I would personally like. It's not required to be that way, but it kind of falls out that way. And I would like to see something where a bit more like, kind of lambdas in the cloud, but, you know, with a bit more than just the ability to run code. So I'm playing around with different ways of trying to do that and see what falls out.
That's really cool.
So I have a hopefully unique vantage point, at least an unusual vantage point, from running our Pragmatic Bookshelf publishing company. I'm sort of sitting at the headwaters. I get to see what people are passionate about, you know, what we get proposals on, what are they talking about at conferences? What's new? What's exciting? What's old? What's boring? You know, who's completely worn out by the latest JavaScript framework that just came out 3 hours ago that now everyone has to use? You know, this sort of thing. So it's a cliche to say, well, I've got my finger on the pulse of the industry. You really can't do that anymore because the industry is like an octopus. You'd need, you know, 100 arms to take all the pulses on all the limbs that are going out every which way. But we do manage to sort of stay ahead of what the leading edge people are thinking. Where are they headed? What are they bored with? What's interesting? What's coming next? And that's a kind of a fun game to play is, okay, why are there all these new JavaScript frameworks coming out in such quick succession? Why does, you know, Hello World and React bring in whatever it is, 10,000 modules or some ridiculous number? You know, these are clearly problems that as an industry, we haven't solved yet. We're still searching. We're still experimenting. So to me, that's the interesting part is sort of that, you know, getting out there on the edge, trying to figure out, okay, you know, there's stuff we know how to do really well. We can make CRUD apps in, you know, PHP or Rails or whatever. Oh, okay, we got that down. Awesome. But there's more to the world than that. So what's next? How do we figure this out? How do we figure this out and do it in such a way that we don't blow our own toes off in the process, because we're really good at that. Right? You know, it's what was that? It's some old joke about, you know, C++. It's like it doesn't blow your toe off. It gives you like a machine gun and a something and some elaborate setup. But yeah, I mean, we've got phenomenally powerful tools compared to, you know, making pictures of Mr. Spock on the teletype writer. You know, we've graduated to phenomenal power with our tooling and cloud-based builds and distribution and concurrency and yada, yada. But what are we doing with that? How many security holes are we leaving open? How many privacy violations are we enabling? You know, there's a lot more riding on what we're doing these days. And, you know, to me, that's all interesting because that to me is what a full stack, quote unquote, developer really is concerned with, right? People are like, oh, I'm full stack, right? I can write JavaScript and I can write, you know, Ruby or something on the back end or Java. Well, okay, that's that kind of the middle, right? You know, full stack goes down from assembly language and gates up to GDPR and international treaties, and that's the stack, baby.
And the other thing is kind of interesting to me, related to what Andy just said, was that when I use current software that's being developed by people today, I'm kind of shocked at how the dependencies have become, I mean, fundamentally ridiculous. And it's not just JavaScript. I mean, I'm doing some home automation stuff at the moment. And a couple of the frameworks that I'm using are written in Python. And the instructions for integrating something into them are, it's just like the old days, like 20 years ago, when compiling something for Linux involved at least a three-day expedition into downloading, oh, wrong version, compiling, oh, kernel patch required, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Make install. Yeah,
if only it was that easy. But we're back to that day, with those days. You know, literally, I spend days playing around with various options, and suddenly it bursts into life, and I haven't got the faintest idea why.
That was the question I was going to ask, was why do you think this is?
I think it's because everybody, well, first of all, people are told that they shouldn't write it if it already exists. And so, you know, if they needed a function to add two numbers, they don't write A plus B. They go and find some adding library somewhere and include that.
Left pad, cough, cough.
Yeah. I mean, that's a little bit facetious, but I seriously see people including 1,000-line modules into their code to do two lines worth of work. The trouble is when they do that, what they're doing is buying just both themselves, but everybody that uses their code, a whole bunch of heartache. Because in those things that you bring in, it brings other things in, and they bring other things in. And eventually, one of them won't work with, you know, language version 1, 2, 3, 4, or whatever it might be. And the whole house of cards comes tumbling down. So I think one of the issues that we need to address is to try to stop people or help people not create these dependency spiderwebs, and instead to look at how to decouple their code properly. I'm not too sure why microservices hasn't become nanoservices and why people aren't writing all their code that way, but that would certainly be a good start.
I've always found it a thing. You know, you get excited about a new language and you dig in kind of at the language level, and it's beautiful, right? It's elegant. It's like this nice bath of cold water of just refreshing logic, and it's just so elegant and it's awesome, and you know, you're loving it. And then you move out from sort of the sphere of influence of just the language itself into the tooling, the environment, the package manager, its interactions with the OS, all, you know, as Dave...
Don't forget the testing framework.
And the testing frameworks. And all of a sudden, right, and deployment, let's not forget deployment because everyone does, you know, you get to this point and this beautiful, you know, wonderful, pristine experience you are having is now... not that, you know, at all. It's a mess. And you're sitting there, like Dave was saying, you're struggling to get this version to work with that version. And, oh, I'm doing this on a Raspberry Pi, and that thing doesn't exist for this particular chip, or I don't have enough RAM, or, you know, somebody didn't anticipate this scenario, so now I can't use the Bluetooth driver at the same time I need the, you know, whatever Frozbot thing. And, you know, that wonderful euphoria of a beautiful, clean language is now back to the same old slog.
That's actually a really good point, because I know I've been caught a few times now where I get like 3 days into something so frustrating, I say, screw this, I'm going to use a different framework. And you go back, and this new framework, yeah, it works. But then eventually, 3 days later, you get back to exactly the same point you were in the first time around. So it's like a little bit like that stone soup tip we have. You know, it starts out nice and easy, and then you don't notice the gradual changes and how it gradually gets harder and harder and harder until you find yourself stationary.
Today's sponsor is Datadog, a monitoring and analytics platform for cloud-scale infrastructure, applications, and logs. Datadog provides deep end-to-end visibility into the health and performance of modern applications. Build rich dashboards, set alerts to identify anomalies, and collaborate with your team to troubleshoot and fix issues fast. Datadog makes it easy for teams to collaborate together and monitor every layer of their stack within a single platform. See for yourself. Start a 14-day free trial today by visiting dtdg.co/sixfiguredeveloper, and Datadog will send you a free t-shirt. It seems to be that there's an expanding and contracting in technology and software in particular, that we start with a particular set of languages that we're comfortable with, and then we discover those new shiny bits, and we go off in a different direction and find out all the wonderfulness that new technology has to offer. And then we get to a roadblock miles down the road, and then we all kind of contract back to our comfort zones and bring the lessons that we've learned back to particular languages. That's why I think, like the JavaScript fatigue and the number of frameworks and libraries out there, and people doing React and Angular and Vue and all these different things and going in separate ways. But then now they're starting to communicate and share the lessons learned, and that, no, maybe you shouldn't bring in 65,000 packages on a Create React app.
Well, and that's an interesting point that you make there about comfort zones, because I think that's kind of the heart of the problem. I mean, we used to say in the old days, well, for some definition of old days, that you would get folks new to the industry who'd maybe only had a few years experience who had actually never experienced a successful project. They'd only worked on a couple of these large enterprise death march quagmire kind of things and didn't have anything really to compare that to know that this could be better or this should be better. That was normal to them, right? And we kind of see even the same thing now. You know, it's very easy to get pigeonholed in some particular job where you've only got a very narrow range of experience. So all you know is Java and its things, or PHP, or whatever the environment happens to be. Back in the first edition of Pragmatic Programmer, we made the bold suggestion you should go out and learn a new language every year to, you know, help keep your skills up, help look at different ways of solving problems, different approaches. And some of the feedback we got was, well, that's great, but what do you do after the first 3 years?
Yeah, I've already learned C, C++, you know, what else?
Yeah, what else? Yeah, I've done all the curly brace languages. I mean, that to me was a really, I mean, it's funny, but it's kind of a telling comment because there was a time when, you know, you could read something like Byte Magazine or Dr. Dobbs Journal and really get a handle on, you know, most of the breadth of the whole industry and know that, hey, look, they're using Smalltalk in banking on Wall Street. They're using, you know, Erlang in telecom. They're using what, you know, whatever somewhere else. So you had a better grasp, I think, of the actual breadth of the industry. And that's seems to be kind of gone now. You know, it's so compartmentalized, so balkanized. People get into their little rut and, right, they'll introduce themselves, you know, I'm a React developer. You know, I used to make fun of people for saying, oh, I'm a Java developer or whatever. That's gotten even worse. Now we're down to, like, you know, whatever, you know, popular framework of the day. And that's become their identification. It's like, you know, I'm a React. No, you're not. You're a problem solver.
Sometimes I question that, though. I've seen plenty of developers who they really are just a React developer, and they don't know anything outside of that scope. If you were to show them a pattern that's 40 years old, but it's not something used in React, it'd blow their minds. You know, not just React, but, you know, it just, sure, we've become so compartmentalized, and the lifespan of developers doesn't seem to be long enough to actually, like, pass down lessons learned. I was reading some papers by Dijkstra, and I'm reading the paper, and it's like, we're dealing with the same thing now. It's like 60, 70 years later. Like, why haven't we learned anything?
It's funny you say that, because I've been doing exactly the same thing. I'm putting together a course on programming languages. And I went back and I read a whole bunch of the Dijkstra original papers and his structured programming papers, or essays, or whatever you call it. And you're absolutely right. I mean, all of those early people were solving problems that we are still solving today. So my question then to the three of you is, how do we fix that? How do we, I mean, we are probably the only industry, only creative industry, which is write only, right? We never, ever read anything else. We just go out there and code. How do we fix that?
You mentioned Dijkstra. I mean, one of my favorite papers of all time was I think it was his Turing Award lecture, where he talks about being the very humble programmer and, you know, not trusting yourself, you know, and doing things like we would do now with unit testing and feedback to confirm your decisions, confirm your understanding of the problem, which is absolutely critical. And that's not what they teach in college or university. They teach, hey, the compiler accepted it, or the interpreter accepted it. Woohoo, ship it. You're good. You're golden. So, you know, we have a number of forces, I think, that kind of breed this sort of false confidence that, you know, hey, I can issue a set of procedural instructions that'll make the turtle go around, or that the compiler will accept. I'm a programmer. I'm good. I'm done. I don't need to go learn anything else. I've got this. And of course, there's quite a bit more to it than that. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Pragmatic Programmer book was so, we didn't plan this. It was wildly successful. We had no idea when we were putting it together. We were just trying to help our clients out at the time. But it became very, very successful and very, very seminal, because we broach on some of these other topics and very much hit the idea that you're not as smart as you think you are. I know I'm not. Right. And try to get around that sort of false confidence that, you know, hey, you can write, you know, a syntactically correct line of code. Whoopee, you know, Dave's mom can probably do that by now from reading the Rails book. That's you know, kind of a low bar. We gotta, there's all this other stuff.
Excuse me, you just that's my mother you're talking about.
And I think I'm sure she writes delightful Rails apps, but yeah, you know, it's there's all this other stuff, and you have to be distrustful of your own judgment, your own code. You know, that's why we do unit testing. That's why we get feedback from the users, from the customer, because we're not certain. So we need to get this level of feedback all the time. And that's a major theme, I think, that sort of runs through the book.
I'm in my 20th year of professional software development. And in the first three or four or five, maybe more years, I was essentially an employee. I would show up in the morning, hopefully on time. I would do a fair amount of work and then leave at the end of the day and go about my life. But it was around year three, four, or five that someone introduced me to the Pragmatic Programmer. And I have my rather worn copy here. And there are still issues. Like I'm comfortable solving problems in a variety of different languages, in a variety of different ways. But it's finding out how to solve a particular problem or digging out what the problem that needs to be solved is. And I happen to flip open the book to a well-worn page that I spent a lot of time on. It was the requirements pit. And a quote here saying, don't gather requirements, dig for them. I think getting requirements is still very difficult to do. Solving a particular problem is relatively easy, but it's understanding what problem needs to be solved.
And one of the problems there is there's an assumption that there is something called a requirement. Like out there somewhere, it may be hidden, there's a requirement. And if I can just find it, then I can do what the user wants. But the reality is that doesn't exist because nobody, whether you're a user or a developer or whatever else, actually knows 100% what they want. A user has some pain and they would like to see that go away. And what happens is that we developers, we press them saying, you know, I need something which is more contractual than that because you're going to sign off on it. And then at the end, I'll produce it and then you pay me. And the customer typically basically will sign anything at that point because they really don't care. They don't understand the details. It doesn't matter to them. What they really want is to get this problem solved. Along the way, as you start to help them with that, their understanding of the problem changes. And so what they want to get done changes. So there is no way that you can actually go out there and find requirements and then implement against them. It's just not possible. And that's not a computing thing. I mean, we had our bathroom remodeled and the guy said, well, what size tile do you want? And we were like, oh, you know. And so he brought in different size tiles and put them down on the floor. And we went, oh, that one, you know. But it's unless you see, people are really, really bad. I mean, Andy says something like, you know, we're really, really bad at predicting the future. And that includes our own future. Often we have to see it. We have to see examples. And what we're really, really good at saying is, I don't like that. And so you have to see a lot of stuff. I don't like that. I don't like that. Until you suddenly find the one that goes, oh, yeah, actually, that might work.
And that's a fundamental misconception, I think, that you know, again, you asked a while back, why is it we have failed to learn from prior art? Why aren't we back reading Dijkstra? Why aren't we, you know, learning from things? There's some real fundamental misunderstandings about the industry and about how software works. And this is the big one, because writing a program is an act of co-creation with the user, the sponsor. It's not, here's the requirements, go off and type some stuff and send me the bill. And, you know, a lot of times you'll see folks say, well, you know, building software is like, it's like building a house. There's, you know, there's an architect and there's plans and you move in. I've had a house built. It don't work like that, right? We came on site every day, not to be jerks about it, but just, you know, because it was kind of cool. Hey, watch the house get built. And, oh, look, the staircase is backwards. And, you know, the top of the stairs is going into a blank wall. Okay, that's not going to work for me. You know, I mean, we found bugs, errors and omissions, whatever, every single day.
When you see that staircase, even if it was correct, you may suddenly say, oh, actually, you know what, looking that in the flesh.
Yeah, yeah.
Wait, that's not the way I envisage it.
Yeah, exactly. And that happened to us a lot with the and I think this is a good analogy with the flow of the house. It's like, oh, you know, we thought we wanted that doorway there. It seemed to make sense on the plans, but when you actually experience the 3D space and you're actually doing your workflow, you know, through the environment, it's like, oh, no, that's not going to work. I'm going to keep banging into this, you know, closet door or the light switch is in the wrong place or whatever. You know, something that you wouldn't realize until you were actually, you know, sort of walking through the space for real. It's like, oh, that's not going to work. And that's exactly what the requirements conversation needs to be. It's shared learning as you're exploring the space that you're building together, saying, well, this sounded like a good idea, but this is not going to work out for our workflow. This is not convenient, or whatever it might be.
Talking about workflow just reminded me, have you seen that movie about Ray Kroc and starting McDonald's? He buys this burger joint and he realizes that it's really inefficient and everything else. So he closes it down and takes the staff off to, I think it was like a basketball court. And they draw and chalk on the ground the equipment that has to be used. And they spend literally an entire week pretending to make burgers. And then when it doesn't work, they move the equipment around on the chalk lines and they try again until they actually have a flow where basically it comes in one side as a bun and some meat and comes out the other side as a burger. And it's just really impressive and really instructive to watch. And again, they had to do it for real. They couldn't just like plan it.
That's a really good point, right? Because what were they doing, right? They were prototyping it. They were getting feedback from a quick prototype. And, you know, we use words carelessly. We say, well, you should prototype your code. That doesn't always mean you're throwing something together in Python or a demo in Photoshop or something like that. You know, it could be post-it notes on a whiteboard. It could be chalk outlines on the floor. I'm picturing sort of bodies when you said that chalk outline. But, you know, that'd be a different app, I guess.
Yeah, I use interpretive dance quite a lot.
You know, hey, if it works, you know, that's the heart of pragmatism, right? If it works for you, you know, go in peace, you know, roll with it.
So how do you get the customer or the client or the user to buy into that pragmatism?
Two things. First of all, if you can explain that to them in a non-confrontational or non-scary way, quite often it just makes sense. You can start telling stories that justify it at a business level. My favorite is that quite often a customer is given one shot at a budget to create something. And so they will throw everything they can think of into this project because they can't come back and get more money for it later on. And so you end up with these Frankenstein projects that really will never work just because there's no cohesion to them whatsoever. And if instead you were to say to this guy, listen, we're not going to spend all your budget. We're going to spend 2 weeks worth of your budget and then another 2 weeks worth and another 2 weeks worth or whatever your period is. And at the end of each of those, we will deliver something that you can use. Quite often what you find, and you can tell this to the customers and they understand, maybe halfway through the planned time, you have given them 80% of the value they wanted. And at that point, they get to say, you know what? Let's stop here and use the remaining time to get 80% on another project. So from their point of view, it's a win. The other way of doing it was you kind of stone soup it into the organization. So I had a guy who was working at a very large company, like tens of thousands of developers. He was a project lead and his particular team finished a project a bit early. And so they were on the bench because they were still waiting for the next one to come through. And so he said to his boss, you know what, we're just bored. You've got anything interesting we can do just like off the cuff? And his boss said, well, there's this project that's been going on now for like 2 years, and it was supposed to take 18 months, and right now it's about 5% complete. You know, it's just a disaster. Could you have a look at it? So he took his team and stole a conference room and started attacking this project. And at the end of the month, they had something ridiculous like 60 or 80% of it done. And the boss said, well, how did you do that? And the guy said, oh, we were lucky. And the guy said, oh, I don't believe that. So he said to his boss, well, give us another one then and see what happens. And so he gave them another project and same thing happened. So at this point, the boss basically, you know, says to them, okay, you will tell me the secret here or else, you know, I'm going to go kill you or something. Okay, well, we're not going to tell you the secret as such, but because it won't work if other people just do it. But instead, what we'll do is we'll take our 12 people and we'll split them into two, and you will find 12 other people, and we'll end up with two teams of 12, where six of them have done this before and six of them haven't. And we will show them what we're doing. And in fact, what they were doing back then was XP, and it just worked for them. And that spread, I mean, basically, it grew, was it exponentially, I guess. So it doubled every, whatever it was, month. And pretty soon they had hundreds of people doing XP. Management were begging them to do it more because it worked. And I think that's the other key point. There's no point in trying to convince someone to do something if it doesn't help them. But if it does help them, it kind of convinces them automatically.
And this is where you run into trouble with a lot of these sort of name branded, big, heavy processes that consulting groups try to sell. You know, it's expensive. You need a ton of consultants, and it's this big giant package. And as a developer, you're looking.
You need a lot of wall for the poster as well.
You need a lot of wall for the poster and all the figures. And you're looking at that going, okay, I'm not seeing the value to myself here. This looks like, you know, pain with extra steps. Why would I do this? Whereas something like XP, which is focusing on, you know, a small set of solid, well-established technical practices, you can actually get personal results from. It does work if you do it. It's always frustrated me that level of technical practice is not really taught in colleges or universities. My son's in college at the moment, and when he first started and was showing me his freshman courses and even his sophomore courses and even into the, you know, beginning of junior year, it's like, okay, this is, where's the meat? Where's the, you know, where's the stuff you actually need to know? You know, their idea of an advanced course a lot of the time is compiler design. That's a lovely thing. You should know how to do that. That's sort of important, but the world really doesn't need you to go out and build compilers, right? It would be nice if you knew how to use Git, if you knew how to work on a team, if you knew how to interview and talk with a user or sponsor to help understand their problem. I mean, there's some core people skills, hard skills. Some people, you know, ironically call them soft skills. They're the hard skill. You need that. You need the technology skills to be able to produce code, get it out the door, get it running, you know, in a reliable manner. You know, you kind of need both sides of that. And yes, you do need, you know, theory, you know, finite state automata and you know, whatever the sort of things that, you know, data structures that you take at school, but you kind of need all of this. And I'm still disappointed that most, not all, but most undergrad programs are trying to turn out computer scientists, not developers.
Well, to be fair, a university is an academic institution. And what you're asking for more is like in England, they call it a technical college. You know, it's a trade school. I don't think that's demeaning at all. I think that the world needs more trade schools. I think the world needs more apprenticeships. I think if what you want to do is become a developer, then you're learning a trade. It's a trade that has considerable technical parts to it, but you're learning a trade. And I think maybe the time has come to separate the two out. I mean, to some extent, the boot camps kind of do that. And I am increasingly impressed with the quality of the boot camps. But there, it still relies on the people participating doing a lot of background work on their own if they're going to be successful long term. So there needs to be something just a little bit beyond that to round people out.
Yeah. And you know, the boot camps are filling a definite need, because what you see at, you know, Votec schools or trade schools is more networking. You know, security issues, sysadmin. It's not really development per se, but sort of the, you know, other tech that you need, you know, to keep everything running. So yeah, there's a definite kind of a hole in the environment there that the boot camps are coming in and starting to fill. But you know, I think it's a great idea. I love it, but it's kind of baby steps still. We're not really quite there yet.
One of the things we wanted to ask you before we let you guys go back to work. The Pragmatic Programmer came out 20 years ago, and you are releasing a new version of the book. what is in the new version of the book, and why should even someone who has the older copy, why should they get the new copy?
It's completely different. And I say that somewhat facetiously, but it is completely different. It's got maybe 30% completely new content, but Dave and I went through and figured, I don't think there's a single page that doesn't have changes on it. We literally changed everything because it's been 20 years. That's, in internet years, that's like one of these alien civilizations that's 20,000 years later and they're, worshiping the floppy disk as a god it's been a long time. A lot has changed. And it was kind of fun when we first started this project. We went back and looked at, reread the book and some of our notes and kind of got back into that headset of 1998, 1999 kind of time frame. AOL was still carpet bombing people with dial-up internet. There was ads for Lycos saying, this is the search engine you need. Use Lycos. Get Lycos or get lost. That was their tagline, right? And of course, everyone's shaking their head. Who? Alta Vista versus Lycos, right? Those were there was no Google, kids. It wasn't there. And every time we would wax poetic about you could download new languages and experiment with this and that, and you could try Eiffel and LaTeX and all this wonderful stuff. And all the time we're capitalizing internet because that was the style in the day because it was the internet, right? This was this big, new, exciting thing. And right, that's a little different today. Yes, it's still a wonderful resource. You can go out and play with any language you want in a REPL in your browser. You don't need to go download all these packages and go through all this stuff. You can push your code and it's being built in the cloud, in a pipeline, and all the rest of that. So that kind of stuff has changed. The landscape of back then, hey, we got it to work. Yay, us. Now it's we got it to work. What are the security implications? What are the privacy implications? Could this be used against us? Could this be used against me? Would I willingly be a consumer of this product I'm building? Or is it something a little more nefarious than that? Is it going to track, every movement, every time I scratch my head, whatever? That kind of stuff, that's all different. That's a whole different world. But by the same token, there's stuff that didn't change.
Like us. It's kind of interesting that the biggest changes in the book, I think, are also to do with the things that change the least, which are us developers. I mean, honestly, the human side of this has been the same for, thousands of years. The difference is that since we wrote the first edition, we've both done a fair amount of research into the human stuff and learning models and theories of conscious versus subconscious and non-conscious or whatever. That has worked its way into the book. And so a lot of the book has kind of like, just almost like incidentally, a lot of suggestions to do with how to use your brain more effectively. Because if you look, most of the best coders don't think about coding that much. And so how do you get to that state? What does it mean to be in that state? That's really important, I think, because it's kind of like we're teaching people how to drive by telling them, now the cylinder goes up and that valve opens. People need to get to the point where they can drive without even realizing they're driving. That's what we're trying to do in the book.
Awesome. One of the things we ask everyone who comes on is to sort of speak to our listeners who are just getting started or, trying to level up. What advice or words of wisdom would you kind of direct directly to those people?
Learn continuously. Don't, just because you got your degree or you went through your boot camp or you've mastered whatever stack you're using at work, that's nice. That's just the beginning. If you've ever read interviews from Elon Musk, this guy is a reading machine. He tears through basically a book a night on whatever topic is of interest. Maybe it's about lasers. Maybe it's about economic systems. Maybe it's about anthropology, whatever. Tears through this kind of material. And that's the kind of approach you need to take. is just always have that curiosity, that itch of, you know, I've always wondered, how does this work? And you pull on that thread and you figure it out. And, oh, I see. Oh, wow, this is a lot more complicated than I realized. And you dig into that and on and on. But it's a continuous process, right? You never stop. Some folks, you know, complain about the rate of change. And there was, you know, some famous paper back when about how the amount of human knowledge used to double like once every century. And then it cut down to about once every 25 years. And the latest estimate, I think, from IBM was that the amount of human knowledge in 2020 will double every 12 to 13 hours.
Oh, wow.
No, that's not the scary part. Scary part, wait for it. The scary part is that as we're experiencing this right now, this is the slowest rate of change we'll experience in our lifetimes. It's monotonically increasing. It's just going to get faster. So, you know, the only solution to that, the only cure is you have to keep learning. You've got to keep researching, looking up stuff, figuring things out, and unlearning. We were very surprised going back and reading a lot of the tips in the first edition of Pragmatic Programmer had a very object-oriented focus to them. I don't think really conscious of that at the time, right? You know, the fish never sees the water it's swimming in. It's just, these are coding tips. They're coding techniques. You go back and look at it. It's like, well, no, it's not really generally applicable. That's a very OO flavored approach, way of looking at it. And there's more to the world than that, right? So that's kind of the thing. You need to keep your mind open, keep a beginner's mind, look at other technologies, look at other industries, and realize that what you're doing now is just that. It's what you're doing now. It's not what you're going to be doing 2 years from now or 5 years from now.
So what he said, but I mean, I think that's really important. But if I was talking to someone just new to the industry, I think I'd also try to be a little bit less scary. I know. Where's the fun in that? But I would basically say, welcome. What you are about to get into is, it's probably one of the most rapidly changing endeavors that human beings have ever been involved in. But it is also possibly the most world-changing, in that what you are doing increasingly is you are designing the world. The world is moving in the direction where developers are basically coming up with solutions, quite often before the problem is even realized. And that is an incredible gift. It's also an incredible responsibility. But I like to think that most people become developers because they like to create stuff and they like to see people using their work. And I think that what we are doing right now is we are having an entire planet using our work. And it's up to us to make sure they're using it for the good.
I want to add one comment to that. You know, there are some corners of our world that engage in at least some level of sort of gatekeeping, that, oh, you can't be a programmer because you don't have a degree, or, you know, the programming language you know is inferior. It's not a real programming language, or this or that, or, you know, you're from the north, you're from the south, it doesn't matter, whatever. Some kind of gatekeeping says you can't be a programmer. And that I find absolutely counterproductive, because the reality is we need all the help we can get. I want everybody to learn at least the basics of how software works and how to write code. I don't want to exclude anyone from this experience, because we need them. We need their input. We need their help. We need all hands to the pump, as they say.
Very cool. If people wanted to follow you guys directly, Twitter or social media, where would they be able to do that?
This is Andy without the accent. You can find me on...
Excuse me, you have a very strong accent.
strong American accent. My homepage is at toolshed.com, and I've got a now page there that explains whatever harebrained experiment or concoction I'm working on currently, which could be anything from the skeleton chucker to a couple science fiction novels to an album of music to, you know, whatever the latest fun toy is. And on Twitter, you can find me at Pragmatic Andy.
And I am Prag Dave, Pragdave, anywhere that I am. And you can look up more about me at pragdave.me.
Cool.
Well, Dave, Andy, thanks so much for coming on. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having us.
Absolutely. Our pleasure.
That was Andy Hunt and Dave Thomas. Andy and Dave wrote The Pragmatic Programmer to help their clients create better software and rediscover the joy of coding. The newly revised 20th anniversary edition is now available on their website, pragprog.com.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.